This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Canadian short story writer Alice Munro is sometimes referred to as North America's Chekhov. She's celebrated for her ability to evoke the spirit of a place, most often the small towns of southwestern Ontario where she grew up and still lives today. Many of her readers simply refer to that region as Alice Munro country. One critic describes her stories as telling portraits of ordinary people living simple lives in a complex way. Munro is the author of one novel and seven previous collections of short fiction, including The Beggar Maid, Friend of My Youth, and Open Secrets. Her new collection, Selected Stories, draws on the work of her entire career. I asked Alice Munro whether she had always felt such a clear affinity for the landscape and the rhythms of her hometown.
From as long as I can remember, I was very affected by the landscape, and maybe less by the town until I grew up and went away. And then remembering things. I used to try to hold everything in my mind. There was a great need for accuracy about it somehow, so that I could see things exactly as they were. And I wouldn't quite call this, it's not so simple as affection. It's just some reality that you recognize as the basic reality for you. And to me, it's that town. I was back there just, you know, I live about 20 miles away. And we were back in Wingham just a few days ago. And I was walking up and down the streets and looking at it and thinking, it's really odd how this place absolutely captured my imagination. Because it's sort of just a typical small town. And yet to me, it was completely unique. And the towns I make in my mind when I'm writing have that quality of enormous importance that towns used to have to people who lived in them, because people didn't go out of town very much. They didn't drive out to work as they do now, and life was lived so completely in that setting that I think probably everything was more meaningful to the people who lived in town, say, in the early 50s than it is now.
Now, your father was a fox farmer at
one time.
I'm not sure I know what that is.
Well, it does sound a bit strange, but what he did really was raise foxes, silver foxes, which are a mutation of red foxes. Women wore silver fox capes, and I don't know if you've ever seen one or not. They started to show up in secondhand clothing stores in the 70s, and they generally look pretty ratty. And later on, about 1940, he started to raise mink as well. And you know about mink. People are still wearing mink.
Was there much money in your house? Did he do well?
Oh, are you kidding? No, it was one of those things at which you can do very well if you get in at the right time and with enough backing. But of course, we didn't. And we kept afloat until after the Second World War, and then things began to go. The market simply disappeared, and this wasn't, naturally enough, it wasn't a subsidized thing like dairy farming, and so nobody really cared if you disappeared. It was a chance you'd taken. So in the late 40s, we had practically no cash flow at all.
Sometimes when things are hard in a family, some kids escape by reading. Were you one of those kids?
I started reading long before there was any need for escape. And also, I must say that even though things were hard, I grew up in a part of the country where things were hard for a lot of people. And so I didn't feel particularly that this was a problem. It wasn't until I got away from home that I realized how difficult it had been for my parents and how much fewer things I could ask for as I was growing up than many of the girls I was in college with and could expect out of life. But I started reading, really, I wouldn't even call it an escape. It was like a heightening. It was a heightening of my real life. And it soon became, by the time I was maybe 9 or 10, tremendously important, and I was the person that I am today who cannot imagine life without this extra dimension of the books that you're reading.
Your parents wanted you to learn to sew and knit.
Yes.
And do housework. But you say you knew you wanted to be a writer since you were 9 or 10.
Yes.
Where did you get the idea? Straight from the books?
Well, I was reading all these books, and I think one day I thought, I didn't want to leave the stories behind. And the way that they wouldn't be shut up in a book and left behind was that I would make up one of my own, and then I would always have it in my head. And so I began to make up stories that were actually very like whatever I happened to be enthralled with in reading at the moment. And so I would always, this wasn't writing anything down, but this was, I remember doing it when I was in about grade 7, having a historical novel that was patterned on some stuff I'd been reading. And then I can remember, all sorts of things that I was writing in my head in high school. And then I think when I got to be about 15, I started trying to write some of them down, and it was a dreadful disappointment how hard it was and how nothing really came out on the page the way I wanted it to.
Well, you went to college. You got married right out of college.
That's right. I didn't graduate. I had a 2-year scholarship. And as I said, there was no money to go further. So after 2 years, I got married. I was 20.
How much did you write when your children were young?
You'd be surprised how much I managed. I'm surprised now when I think about it. I tried something almost every day. My children took naps. Naps were very important in our family. And then after a while, they went to school. And I would try, but I had to tear up most of the things I wrote. And this wasn't really a matter of being a housewife and a mother of small children and not having enough time. It was simply a matter of learning my craft, which took me a long time.
I'm thinking of a quote from one of the characters in your stories that spoke to me as a parent. In my own house, you write, I seem to be often looking for a place to hide, sometimes from the children, but more often from the jobs to be done and the phone ringing and the sociability of the neighborhood. I wanted to hide so that I could get busy at my real work, which was a sort of wooing of distant parts of myself. What form did that wooing of distant parts of yourself take?
You know what it is? It's just sitting and looking at the wall or looking out the window, usually with a cup of coffee going cold beside me. And it's not really trance-like or anything like meditation. My word for it to the children and my husband is just, I'm thinking. But I'm not really thinking in a logical way. I am just trying to get some feeling, picture, necessity to come straight in my head. And that is one of the hardest things to do because you look like you're not doing anything.
That's exactly right. And guilt and parenting, they go together. But and I hope you don't take this wrong. I would think that if you were, say, a scientist who went off from the family to discover the cure for cancer, that's one thing. But writing seems to induce so much guilt. It's so literally self-centered.
Because it's literally self-centered. It also may come to nothing. It's not like a job you have. And it's very hard to justify. But I think it's particularly hard to justify for women. I know lots of male writers who at the same stage that I was at would have actually a room in the house where they went and did this business. And everybody would sort of make sure that Dad wasn't disturbed. But generally, there was a wife who was holding the fort. And for women, there isn't any setup like this. And there also isn't in women of my generation. There tends not to be the feeling that this is what you deserve. I still find it hard to think that I deserve that time.
To this day?
To this day. I can be made to feel guilty if a friend phones just to chat, and I screen my calls and I don't answer the phone and decide to call her back later, I will feel guilty. I'll feel guilty. And also just about all the things that I could be doing to be a better homemaker as I was trained to be. And I'm not. For instance, there are weeds in my flower bed I'm thinking about. Now, that is on the edge of my consciousness all the time as I write. But I must say, I've managed so that this isn't a big problem. People get used to guilt, you know. You live with it.
One critic referred to your writing as gossip informed by genius.
I know.
Well, I can understand you enjoying the genius part of that.
I enjoy the gossip part, too.
Well, what about the gossip? Do you like that description of your writing? What is that
word?
Yes,
I think I do, because, of course, it's redeemed by the genius. If it had been called gossip, I might have been rather huffy. But gossip, there's a pretty wide interpretation for gossip, isn't there? There can be very malicious gossip, which is actually spreading rotten and perhaps untrue stories about people. And there can be gossip, and I think women have done this always, in which you get together and you simply try to figure out life. You talk about your sister-in-law's divorce or somebody's problems with their mother-in-law or something, but it's trying to analyze what people are like, what people say and what they think, which may be different things, and gathering in all the evidence you have for this. You listen to women on the train or on the bus. And when I say that women gossip, I'm not using it as a pejorative thing at all. I think this is something we've always done. We try to make sense of the world around us or to record it, and generally in terms of human relationships.
Are you the kind of person who always knows what's going on in your town?
Yes. And when I was a young wife and mother and I had friends who were in the same situation, we would get together maybe about once a week, and we'd drink endless cups of coffee and smoke endless cigarettes, because you did in those days, and just tell the truth about everything. I suppose it could be called gossip, but mostly it was hilarious. And I think, we laughed all the time, even though what we were talking about was probably disappointment and frustration things that didn't make us particularly happy. But we just, we were together, and we were sharing all this stuff. And we were enormously helpful to each other, I think.
Alice Munro is my guest. She's one of Canada's leading fiction writers. Her short stories appear in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, and The Paris Review. Her latest collection, Selected Stories, draws from her work of the past two decades. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Canadian writer Alice Munro. Many of her short stories are about women who are unhappy in love. One of Munro's characters says that some women like herself might be always on the lookout for an insanity that could contain them. For what was living with a man if it wasn't living inside his insanity? I suggested that was a certain kind of romance many women seek out as a rebellion against a Victorian and sexually repressed upbringing.
I think there was probably a time when the only escape from some very confining life, and there's still maybe something in this, and not just for women, for men too, is a wild and probably doomed love affair. And that was partly what I meant in the passage you read, but I also meant, it seems that in long-term relationships, often the woman's way of accommodating is to live inside. What I think further along in the paragraph I say, you know, the insanity could be something quite ordinary, like his fanatical devotion to a baseball team or something like that. But she has got to get inside it make it hers as well. She moves from a position of being able to look at this objectively to having given herself up in a way.
It's a survival skill women learn, to submerge.
Well, it's not just that. I think some women want to do it too, because that's partly what I was writing about. I was writing about this rather ordinary survival skill, but then also the other thing where the character in that story, I think, says to herself that she's got to find a really good insanity. I mean, just an ordinary one won't work for her. She has got to find a man who is extremely forceful, self-sufficient, and who lives in the world on his own terms. And if she wants to be with him, she will have to live on those terms. So I think it's an attraction as well as a survival thing.
You've written series of short stories that share the same characters, and a reader can trace a character's development through the stories. Why didn't you make those stories into a novel? Or what's the difference for you between writing these short fiction and a novel?
You know, I really don't know. I used to try to write novels because, you know, when I started out writing, what you did was write a few short stories until you sort of got on your feet and then you wrote a novel. And that's what I thought I should do, and it was also what publishers thought I should do. And I tried and tried and tried, and something always went wrong. I got bored with the novel. Things got flabby. And I didn't feel the right tension. I feel very tense about short stories, just as if you're on a tightrope, or if there's a rope pulling you somewhere. And I didn't get that feeling when I tried to write novels. I did write Lives of Girls and Women, which is a very episodic sort of novel, and it's the usual thing about, you know, growing up, childhood, and adolescence. And I could only do that after I got it chopped into very distinct segments and could do it that way. So it was almost like working at a series of stories. And this may have something to do with the fact that when I was a young mother, I couldn't possibly take a year out of my life to write a novel. I could take a month to write a story and then, you know, catch up on all the things I'd let go. But it got to be my habit, and it got to be the only way I can now write fiction. And yet the stories are very untidy stories. They tend to have a lot of, different pathways, and I try to, I don't try to, but I find myself shaping them in ways that are rather strange. So what I'm doing now, I guess, is writing ever longer stories.
Do you ever fear that at the end of your career, you'll have all of these stories, but it will feel to you as if they're bits and pieces of things?
You know, that's what Catherine Mansfield said. She said how awful it would be to die. Of course, she died when she was 32, I think, and she said, how terrible to leave all these bits and pieces. And I used to think of that quite a bit, but I don't now, because stories I've found can have a longer life than novels. If they're picked up for anthologies, they keep alive, and then a book of stories may be reissued just as easily as a novel. And so, that doesn't worry me at all anymore. I think of each story as the main, while I'm doing it, it's the main work of my life. And I can hardly remember what I used to write before I started doing it. And then when I'm finished with it, it goes out there and joins all these other offspring, and I hardly think of it again. So I guess I don't think in terms of what I'm going to leave behind or what my reputation is. I'm always just thinking of the work I'm doing right now.
I'm thinking of one of the characters in your story, Material. She reads a short story by her ex-husband, who she never thought would turn out to be a decent writer.
And, that's right.
And the story affects her very deeply, and she's envious that he can, I think in the character's words, turn a lifetime of memories into art, while for her they're just useless baggage. Now, I imagine this is bitterness talking, that this character...
Yes, I think it's bitterness, because I think it's because of her particular experience with that man that she feels this way. I don't for one minute think that people envy me for turning a lifetime of experience into art or into stories. Because I think that's what what I was talking about before. That's what the women on the bus are doing. That's what women in kitchens are doing, and I think men do it too. My husband is a World War II veteran, and I know when I listen to his friends that I feel that they are creating life stories.
You called your stories entertainments at one
yes.
point. Is that exactly what you mean? That they come lightly?
I want them to be entertaining. Nothing bothers me worse than being written about as a bleak or grim writer, and it happens. And I don't intend this, because I can be entertained by a very serious story. Anything that surprises me, that makes me see anything differently, anything that gives me a gift, is entertaining. It lightens my spirits. It makes me happier. That's what I think art does for people. And I think what is thought of as serious art can do this perhaps more readily than art which sets out to be frivolous.
Alice Munro, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you.
Alice Munro's new book is Selected Stories. This is Fresh Air.